Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply. Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply.
You know what I want? I want to talk to you.
Hello and welcome to the Raptors Weekly Podcast. I'm Earl Sampson Folk. And the day after Kawhi Leonard made his decision, Paul George was traded to the Clippers. I am joined today by my colleague Matt Shantz over at Raptors Republic. Matt, how are you doing today, man?
I am doing rather well, all things considered.
All things considered. Now, maybe you can elaborate on that and that'll get us going on the podcast. All things considered.
Yeah, I think yesterday was generally an overly optimistic day for Raptors fans, considering we just lost our best player for nothing in free agency. But we're champs, so you can't take away the banner. So life is pretty grand.
I think I agree with that. I was on CBC yesterday, and that was pretty much my takeaway. It was like, well, you know, things are still pretty good. We're the champs. It sucks that he left, but you can never take away the banner. And some NBA teams, they never get it and maybe never will. I guess that's how the league works. Kawhi Leonard isn't the Robin Hood for every team, but he was for us for 1 year, sharing the wealth.
Exactly. Yeah.
And the first thing I want to talk about then is obviously that. So I'll frame it for us. He left for the Clippers. A lot of stuff happened. Paul George, now his teammate there. I think the first question, is this a reflection of the no one wants to play in Toronto problem or narrative? I can't remember a finals MVP ever leaving his team before. Is this a stark reminder that no matter what, the Raptors can never play in free agency? Or is Kawhi just a unique and driven player who takes what he wants? Is it a bit of both? What do you think?
I think that there will be people who use this to support the narrative that players do not want to sign in Toronto. But if you look over the last 5 years, anybody the Raptors have wanted to keep, they've kept. And that's been a real success from the Masai Ujiri era. But as far as Kawhi goes, it was clear all along, or I guess in hindsight, you know, we had the whole he stay movement. But looking at it all, he wanted to go home. He wanted to be in LA. He had his sights set on that. And so it wasn't a matter of Toronto can't keep players. It was Toronto can be successful, but the player empowerment movement is here, and that's okay. It's as long as he came, he lived out his contractual obligations, then it's fine. And that was always the case.
Living out the contractual obligations. What a way to put it. That's very succinct. It sounds dystopian almost. I guess, so what is the thing that separates Toronto then? Because if Toronto's able to keep free agents, and we'll dive into the narrative a little bit, maybe we can dispel it. Toronto's able to keep their incumbent free agents, sounds like. Kyle Lowry stayed, Serge Ibaka stayed, DeMar DeRozan stayed. All the guys sticking around. Kawhi Leonard did leave. But the Raptors, like many other teams, and the most important part of that statement, like many other teams, aren't players in getting big names in free agency. There's usually only about five or so teams that are able to accrue those types of players. Why do you think that it's only attributed to the Raptors not being able to play in free agency when teams like Charlotte are paying Rozier Oklahoma City does not sign anybody in free agency, not like we're used to seeing from maybe a Miami or LA. What do you think about that?
I think the difference in expectations is clear. Toronto has had successful blips throughout their history. Obviously, they've had a lot of failure, a lot of disappointing years and endings. But the expectation is still that they are aiming to compete. They are wanting to be a championship contender. Masai has made that very clear during his time. The end goal was to get the ring and to get the banner, and we're there. Whereas I think we have that expectation because while we are outside of the U.S., we are still a large market. We have the financial means. We have a very wealthy ownership group. And that kind of end goal, whereas teams like Charlotte that you mentioned, or Orlando or Sacramento or all those other teams that can't sign free agents, they don't have that same level of expectation. And they also maybe have a little bit of a protective view as they are small markets and therefore they are limited. Toronto is a large market. Therefore, why do they struggle in that area?
Okay, so let's dive in. Why do you think that the Raptors struggle in that area? What makes you worry? What is the truth to that? What are the false parts behind it? What's the truth to it?
Up until now, I think that a big chunk of it has been the failures of the franchise. We did not have a strong management group in place for a long time, and that's changed. We did not have a history to sell, whereas we hear Pat Riley, when he meets with free agents, he can plop down his bag of championship rings and they all hear the clinking of the jewelry. So I wonder how much of that can change. And I think the more players leave Toronto and the narrative is that they are disappointed to be leaving Toronto, like Lou Will, he was disappointed when he left. Patrick Patterson was very disappointed when he left. It's going to start to change that we hear more and more players talk about how they love being in Toronto. The NBA is becoming more international year by year. So I don't think it's going to be a perpetual problem, particularly now that we have that gold, touch on our collar of our jerseys. There's a little bit more credibility to what the franchise is capable of.
You brought up that the Raptors, they have like a world-class franchise in a lot of ways, but also we've been emboldened and kind of a plucky upstart type of team for a long time. And maybe that's more so having to do with how the team was assembled, the, island of misfit toys that where it began. But there's also, I think, in Canada, looking outwards towards the United States, kind of this plucky upstart feeling. The Raptors having won, does that feeling fall away? Do they have to grapple with something new where they've won and now they have to have some sort of fall from grace where they either have to rebuild or retool? What do you think about next year for them?
Well, it entirely depends on what moves are made the remainder of the summer. I don't think that we are in that championship picture, but can we make a deep and solid playoff run? Potentially. I think that the second round is a clear objective and should be an easy target if the team retains, Lowry and Gasol and Ibaka and those key vets. Is there an outside chance at a conference finals? Potentially, depending on how the bracket breaks. But after this year, there's going to be a lot of money available and from the Raptors and free agency. Stars are coming aligned in 2 years, and it's been a not so public secret that Masai has his eyes set on Giannis. So there is a lot in play in the next couple of years that could change. Or if nothing falls the Raptors' way, they would be beginning a rebuild in earnest with Siakam, with OG, potentially with Fred, and just kind of starting over with the young pieces that they have in place. So we're kind of at that turning point, and anybody who bets on the Raptors right now either has some real inside secret or has a gambling issue.
Yeah, I think that's the question, is the turning point. So mostly what I'm thinking about is you brought up that the Raptors are going to have an absurd amount of cap space after this year. They have the $30 million of Kyle Lowry's contract, $20 million of Serge Ibaka, and $26 million of Marc Gasol, all coming off the books. And then you also bring up the vaunted summer of 2021. Everybody's talking about Giannis will be a free agent. That's the idea, I think. What do the Raptors do? Do they hang out during that 1 year and try and save for the vaunted free agency? Or do they jumpstart things and maybe trade, like Bruce Arthur mentioned in his piece for the Toronto Star? Maybe the Raptors look to jumpstart the rebuild, get assets for one of, maybe two of, Lowry, Gasol, or Ibaka. And like you said, they should be able to. And with Kyle Lowry leading the team, you have a young, burgeoning star in Pascal Siakam, OG Anunoby hopefully looking to make improvements, and the incumbent veterans like Van Vliet, who now after that finals should be considered a veteran, Gasol a veteran, Ibaka a veteran. They can run it back and have lots of success, but looking towards the future, would you rather the Raptors go after regular season success and a decent playoff run, or would you rather they try and jumpstart something and start building new?
Me personally, I think I'd probably lean more towards run it back, have a fun year, have a year to celebrate, celebrate Gasol, celebrate Lowry, celebrate Ibaka and what they brought to this team and how they helped deliver a championship. That's my sentimentality coming out, that this was the most fun year that I've had being a basketball fan, being a Raptors fan, being a Raptors writer, all of that. And it was just a real treat. And so to have a lot of those key players then leaving would be disappointing. It would kind of remove some of the grandeur of the moment for me. So personally, I more so lean towards run it back, but it's also if somebody throws out an offer that can't be refused or is in the betterment of the long-term outlook of this franchise, I have no doubt that Masai would jump on that opportunity. He is very forward-thinking. He's shown that. So if somebody wants to give up assets for Gasol or Ibaka, great. If somebody really wants to pay for Lowry and there's an opportunity to send him somewhere that he could compete, I'd be happy for that. It would be really disappointing to see him leave, but that's kind of the crux of where we're at. So I'm stuck between heart and head on this one.
Right. And that's why I asked about the plucky upstart franchise and what we're perceived to be and how we transition from a championship team who loses their finals MVP, which is unheard of. Most teams, like even the Dirk Nowitzki team that won in 2011, they did have their fall from grace, but they still had their incumbent star. The Raptors, directly after, have to pivot at least in some way away from the Kawhi Leonard era, which only lasted 1 year. Would you rather, and I guess this is the conversation, right? The whole conversation. Masai Ujiri scoffed at sentimentality and tried to supercharge the team. He traded DeMar DeRozan, and in came Kawhi Leonard. Do you think it's more likely or less likely that he scoffs at sentimentality this time and jumpstarts a rebuild with one of Kyle Lowry? Because in a way, it's maybe there is a second or third round playoff run in this team. But also, listening to Masai in years past, that isn't what he wants. And is he looking to run it back strictly for those nice feelings? Or if things go bad, you have kind of those things stripped away from you without you trading it away. You just maybe a Kyle Lowry, Ibaka, Gasol, somebody has maladies and things just start falling apart and the team, that's a sadder version. Things like that happen. What do you think Masai does looking at his body of work and his, I guess, the way he turns down sentimentality in that way? What do you think happens? Not what you want to happen, but what do you think would happen?
I would guess that at least one of Lowry, Ibaka, and Gasol gets moved before training camp opens, likely a second by the trade deadline as teams are kind of gearing up for a finals push. It's a unique situation across the league with some unfortunate injuries to Klay Thompson, no one knows what his status will be like or his capabilities come playoff time. Durant is going to miss the year. And there's a lot of teams that view themselves as a prime contender to raise a banner. And with that being the case, I think that it is going to be a movement era this summer and at the deadline where teams look to gear up and add those key pieces and have a few options available from the Raptors that have shown capable of winning a championship and being key contributors to that very recently. There's going to be some serious offers, I think. So I'm going to guess that he makes movement. When you mentioned the Dallas situation, yes, they did still have their incumbent star in Dirk, but they made a lot of peripheral moves that changed their trajectory, and that's happened with franchises. The unique thing, I think, in this situation is while the Raptors haven't retained Kawhi in their incumbent star, they do have an up-and-coming, you know, successive star in Pascal Siakam. So I wonder if kind of the movement or the decision of the direction that Masai chooses, that it'll be almost dependent on what he views as Siakam's ceiling. If he thinks Siakam can take another leap, maybe we just run it back and see what happens. If he thinks that Siakam's leap or OG's leap is coming in 2 years, then maybe that's a sign that he is ready to make that move.
What do you think is Siakam's ceiling? What do you think his leap looks like this year? If we're talking about it, I mean, what do you think his trajectory is this year?
I wonder if it's similar to DeMar in that each year we're going to see one or two new things. And even during the season, we see him adapt and learn on the fly. I think what we already have is an elite two-way player. He's likely top 20 in the NBA already, which is insanity. With a couple tweaks, maybe he can make it into the top 10, top 15. I'd like to see him kind of work on a little pull-up jumper. So catch and shoot from three, he's already, you know, reasonably proficient at that, and I think that he'll improve. He's good at attacking off the drive and has counter moves. But if he can kind of make that little step-up jumper from the mid-range, with his adjustments and how he can kind of attack and alter his directions, I think that will really open up the game for him as well as for passing angles.
Interesting. I guess the thing I want to talk about regarding Pascal is there's two things. One, if the Raptors run it back, it'll be probably close to a top four seed, probably definitely top six. You could book that if they do run it back. Who gets the all-star bid between Pascal and Kyle? And then after that, if Kyle does go, what does Pascal look like truly as a number one option on offense? Because he is an unorthodox piece. Even in that 32-point game, he wasn't scoring. In the finals I'm referring to, he wasn't scoring as a first option in that game. He was getting out on the break. He's taking advantage of pseudo-transition. And he was really, he scores in very unique ways, but maybe not stylistically like a number one option offense scores. There are still the times where you get the clear out on the weak side and he can really take someone in the post. But there are the times we've seen him ISO and pull up are few and far between. Like you alluded to, maybe that's something he adds. So the all-star, who gets it, Kyle or Siakam, if they run it back? And if they don't run it back, what struggles and successes do you expect to see from Pascal as a number one option?
If they run it back, I expect that Siakam will be the all-star. And I think that he will earn that very clearly. It wouldn't shock me if we hear his name in consideration for All-NBA at the end of the season. And that's likely a little bit optimistic of me, but he's a very, very talented player. And I, based on his work ethic and how he's grown over the last 2 years, it's on the table. It's an option for him to pursue. In regards to what it would look like for him as a primary option, probably a little bit clunky at first, and he would need to be surrounded by more shooters. So you need to have somebody like Fred as an outlet, as a secondary creator. having a big beside him who can stretch the floor while also passing. So a Gasol type player fits that mold well, and that he can help create those looks for Siakam, as well as help help open the floor with screens or with shooting. So he would need a roster kind of built towards his tendencies. But with the Raptors' free-flowing style, they already have a lot of those options available.
Good. Yeah. I think, so the last question I'll ask about Pascal before we move on to the wing position, Stanley Johnson, OG, and the hole there is we've seen bigs, particularly fours and fives. When that guy is the best on your team, it's really, really hard to just waltz into the playoffs. Whereas if you have a really good lead guard, a la Dame, DeMar, Kyle, CJ, the Portland, Toronto guys, and now the Spurs for with DeMar, you can get into the playoffs genuinely because you run a lot of pick and roll. They have the ball in their hands a large percentage of the regular season. What do you think the Raptors, if it does come down to Pascal playing the four, we've seen teams with Anthony Davis, DeMarcus Cousins, Karl-Anthony Towns all struggle to have really strong regular seasons when their best player is at the big man position. How would you, and this is your answer, and then what do you think Masai would do as far as building around Pascal? I know you mentioned shooters, but are there any players or roles you think specifically besides just shooting?
You would need a couple of people who are good at slashing. I think that's something that Siakam has shown to be a strength of his, is finding people off movement. So if he's in the post or he's dribble, he's on the attack, that he and Poeltl, for example, had excellent chemistry, that he created lots of dump off opportunities for him. And he found both Gasol and Serge for some looks this year, as well as kicking it to corners. So I think you need people who are good read and react, because that's, you know, Pascal has made it, has said as much, that he doesn't really plan out what he's doing. It's a read and react type of situation. So he waits to see how the defense is responding to him and then tries to adjust on the fly. So the more high IQ players that you have to find those open space and to reorient, to slash when needed, I think that's been a real hallmark of what Masai has looked for in the draft and in free agency, is players who think the game at a high level and a fast level so that they can adjust.
And what do you think Masai would do? Do you think Masai has the same game plan for Siakam's future as you?
I would guess so. The rumored Paul George conversation, and it's come out obviously that the Raptors were a leverage play in that. But the move fell apart, according to all reports, when OKC asked for Siakam to be included. He was a no-go and a refusal in the Kawhi Leonard conversations. And so he is clearly the focus right now of the franchise long-term as a tool and a player for contention themselves, as well as a recruitment based on his low cap hold next summer, his high level of play, his personality. I think people are going to want to play with him, and he's going to be a draw.
Those are good answers. I like that a lot. I think it steps towards a really, really big conversation. I don't think either you or I are going to be the ones to have, but do big men drive teams, or do guards drive teams? Like, are big men the ceiling lifters and are guards the floor lifters? And can Pascal be the incumbent star to lead them? I think is going to be a super interesting question going forward. And just one slot down at the three, the small forward position, the Raptors now have a gaping hole. They recently signed Stanley Johnson for 2 years, $7.5 million. They have their incumbent lovable son, OG Anunoby, sitting there ready to reprise his role from his rookie year, I assume. And so you have around Pascal, we were just talking, and Kyle maybe is there, maybe isn't. We'll see. But we're talking about surrounding Pascal with shooters. And you have Stanley Johnson, who I think is shooting splits in 6,000 minutes, is like 37% from the field, 29% from three. You have OG Anunoby, who, when he has his feet set, is a really good shooter. Well, maybe not really good, but is a decent shooter, decent enough, and has little to no pull-up game. Like you said before, though, having high IQ guys who can cut and slash the basket is important. Both Stanley Johnson and OG Anunoby, specifically OG, have flashed that, and OG is really good finishing around the rim. How do you think that position bears out for the Raptors during this regular season? OG, I'm sure, will get the position, but how do you think he does in it?
I'm expecting a leap, not quite a Siakam level, but I think that we're going to see some things from OG this year, and I will happily admit it. I'm an OG homer. I was thrilled when we drafted him. He was my target the entire year, and just was shocked when he fell as far as he did. Defensively, he's there. As you said, when he gets his feet set, his shot is reasonably effective. And he's not quite getting attention at that level yet. But I think the summer is going to be a big one developmentally for him. Hopefully he gets healthy and he's ready to go. With his ability to cut, I think that will be helpful. So he will be a primary starter for the team. I think that he'll go through little waves of success and waves of struggle with as teams adjust to him. But I think that we're going to see a great year from OG. But in regards to starters, it wouldn't shock me if both OG and Stanley Johnson were starters this year. In regards to, we lost both Danny Green and Kawhi. And I wonder if OG, with his ability to chase guards and kind of being a more switchable unit, whether we could see a group of Lowry, OG, Stanley Johnson, Pascal Siakam, and either Serge or Gasol as a starting unit.
That would be interesting. I would be shocked if they started OG at the two. That would definitely be something. I'd be a fan of it, though. A long time ago, for a different site, actually, I wrote about how the pull-up three changed the NBA, citing Steph Curry, Kyle Lowry, and Victor Oladipo. Steph Curry for helping incite the change, and then how Kyle Lowry and Victor Oladipo both completely revolutionized their own games by incorporating the pull-up three. Both Kyle Lowry and Victor Oladipo, their percentages at the rim went up 10% shooting after they incorporated the pull-up three and started shooting it at a decent rate. OG Anunoby was pretty horrendous as a pick-and-roll ball handler and as a guy coming off of dribble handoffs. He does have a limited dribble package right now, but also, like I said earlier, he's kind of horrible when pulling up. He shot like 16% on pull-up threes this year. He doesn't take them very often, and he's much better when he's setting his feet. But also, there are times during his rookie year and during his sophomore year where we saw him coming downhill, making advanced passes to the corners or to the dunker spot, and he has flashed vision that is actually really great. Do you think that going forward, if he wants to be more than a 3-and-D player, and like you were saying, you expect to jump this year, is he jumping towards a 3-and-D player, more of a Trevor Ariza, where he's just going to keep working on those corner triples, those set shot triples, and playing more defense, chasing guards around screens, like you said? He's an incredible isolation defender already. Or does he take a step towards some of those actions where he's, you know, operating in the dribble handoff or the pick and roll? Where do you think he steps towards? And what do you think is an identifier of who he is? Is it the vision that we've seen? Or is it the lack of the pull-up and the lack of the dribble? Which do you think is more, I guess, indicative of where he's headed?
I think opening up the dribble package is an intriguing idea, because, as you said, we have seen little glimpses of his passing acumen. It's but in order to get to those moments, he needs to be able to create a little offense on his own. So be able to attack more off of non-straight lines, have a little bit tighter of a handle. That was what really opened up the game for DeMar DeRozan. That was kind of his first big leap was when he was actually able to successfully dribble around opponents. And so that will be a step that OG definitely needs to work on and to tighten. Primarily, I still think that he'll be a 3-and-D player. I don't know if he'll ever get to the point where he is a creator for others on a even secondary level, but as having a high level kind of fourth option in the dribble rankings, that's still an elite player in regards to building a successful core.
Does that seem at all sobering from where maybe I know you and I both rate him really highly, but it was kind of crazy after that first year. He was fantastic. He was hitting game-tying threes against the Cavs in the playoffs in the dying seconds. He was one of the net rating gods of the NBA in his rookie year, and he shot a better percent from downtown. He generally excelled at things that people didn't think he would excel at in his first year. It was like walking on air. Is that take saying, you know what, I think it is just 3-and-D for OG. Is that sobering compared to where we thought, you know, maybe this guy does take a step towards a Kawhi-esque career?
He's got a lot of similarities to Kawhi in regards to physical build and defensive tools, and I think that's why it was a fun and hopeful comparison to make, even if not a realistic one. But in regards to, is it disappointing if he becomes a elite 3-and-D player? I don't think so. He can still add other elements to his game, but what you were saying in regards to being a plus-minus god and hitting game-tying three-pointers, and he can still do all of those things even if he doesn't become a primary option. And having somebody capable of that who's not being guarded regularly by a primary defender, that's still necessary to win in the NBA. And so is it disappointing if he only becomes an elite role player? I don't think so. It's an unfair expectation to put on somebody that they have to become a top 20 player in order to be a successful part of a roster. It's very rare that that comes along, and just look at Siakam. We never saw it from him. Oladipo, it was not expected of him after years of struggle. So it could still come. It could be a surprise, but if he just becomes a know your role, excel in that, and help your team dominate when you're on the floor, well, if your team's dominating with you, then you're doing well.
I suppose. Well, the reason I use the term sobering is it's kind of a step back from the expectations, and also looking at wing players like an Otto Porter Jr. or a Harrison Barnes, guys who play defense and hit triples, but maybe don't pass as well as we thought. They get paid a little bit much because their physical profile and their ability to hit shots and their defense, and then people immediately become kind of disappointed with who they are as a player. So I wondered if OG had something like that in his future, or if we can hold back going from where in his rookie year we were saying, well, this guy might be the next Kawhi Leonard, to now we have to say maybe he's just an elite 3-and-D guy, which, as you mentioned, is a great thing to be able to say, but is different than what was initially said. And then, like the Boston Celtics fans who are having to deal with maybe saying that Jason Tatum isn't a lock for an MVP candidate in 3 years, which is what mostly everybody thought after his first year. So it's just dealing with that step back, maintaining the frame you're looking at everything in.
I guess it depends on how realistically you assumed that possibility was. For me, whenever the Kawhi Leonard comparison came up, and that was a hopeful thing, it was still maybe this is a 0.05% chance that he could get to that level, because it is such rarefied air to become that type of player. So if somebody thought that that was a reasonable expectation or a 10% expectation, that he could become that, then yes, I can see why it would be sobering. But it all depends on your perspective of what likelihood was that to happen. And am I...
Sorry, go ahead.
Am I saying that it's completely off the table? Not at all. He still has the physical profile. He still, as you said, has a bit of a passing acumen that has been a surprise to most. He's an elite defender already, and you know there's areas that he could improve kind of off ball. He's working on his shooting touch. The pull-up jumper is kind of the toughest to add to your game, so maybe that could come in the future as he develops more feel. So it's all those tools are still there. It's just a matter of what percentage chance do you think that it could actually happen?
Yeah. Well, I guess what spurs this on, right, is the role he was cast in this year. He was asked to create a lot more, and it did seem like the Raptors were grooming him towards something rather than just the sticking to the 3-and-D thing. Even when I was in Toronto and I asked Nick Nurse about it, he did say before OG had his really unfortunate appendectomy was that they're looking more towards getting OG towards something more like a role rather than trying to have him create and do all those things that he was asked of this year, which might have been he was miscast in that role a little bit. And I'm not sure if that was just from what they saw at practices or in the summer, or if that was, you know, looking at the same thing that everybody else was after his rookie year and saying, like, maybe let's push OG to transform into a different type of player. And maybe we're looking at a more solid type of player and something he's growing towards that isn't that, but is still very good, as you alluded to. The next thing, I asked you beforehand to theory craft a trade proposal, one that you would be very happy with, a dream trade of yours that is also somewhat realistic. What do you have for us?
Okay, so for starters, let's make it clear that you gave me 20 minutes to work on this dream trade proposal. So it's not like you asked me several days. It's hard to put together a package that I could see, one, working financially, two, incentivizing the Raptors enough to deal with it, and three, it's, at this moment, Gasol and Ibaka are great role players, but there's not a lot of need right now for starting centers across the NBA. Now, granted, Gasol would be an upgrade over many, so would Ibaka, but enough to incentivize a team to take on additional salary when the Raptors wouldn't want to take on more than kind of 2 years of money in incoming contracts to keep open that summer of 2021. So as I messed around with it, I was looking to see who could be interested in what types of players, and Lowry to the Nuggets kind of caught my eye a little bit. They could use another guard. They could use a defender at the point of attack, and Lowry brings that, as well as he is good on switches, as you know, we all know that nobody can post Lowry. And the Nuggets are at a point where they are ready to compete, and they see themselves in that championship picture. So what I came up with, and it obviously needs to be tweaked a little bit, would be we take on the final year of Plumlee's contract. We get 3 years of Will Barton at $12 million. And then we also get Monty Morris and a first-round pick. So the incentivize for the Raptors is we get a 2020 first-round pick to kind of add to the hall of young players. Monty Morris showed a lot this year as a young point guard in the league. Will Barton gives them a shooting guard option, and Plumlee is just kind of the salary filler. And while we are sending out Lowry, which would be really hard, we're at least sending him somewhere that he could compete and kind of doing right by him in that way. So that was my rough come up in the last 20 minutes.
I think that's actually really funny because, oddly enough, when I was doing my interview yesterday on CBC, they asked me the same question. And my take was that Kyle Lowry to the Nuggets, who could use him. And also, it would be nice to get back a first-round pick and maybe a Will Barton, was what I said. So that's really funny that our brains went to the same place. I feel like that's a good point to say that we're going to get into the Twitter questions. So, listener, that's coming soon. Welcome back to the Raptors Weekly Podcast. Still hosting Samson Folk, still joined by the fantastic Matt Shantz. And we're going to answer some Twitter questions. The first Twitter question is from myself, but not via Twitter. Matt, you have spurned coffee for so long, even changing the fabric of Raptors Republic morning coffee segments by changing it to morning tea for one terrible morning. What makes you drink tea instead of coffee outside of the, oh, obviously it's healthier. Forget that. Make another case. Come on, man.
All right, here's my argument. Coffee is disgusting. It is bitter and unpleasant, and people only drink it because they've been socialized to believe that it's a positive for them. And that's my whole argument. It is awful. The only good thing about coffee is the smell.
Why don't we just get together and eat a bunch of caramels? The Goodwill Hunting.
And tea is lovely. It's, you know, you can have different kinds. There's different flavors. You can still add kind of different flavor profiles to it. And it's just, you get a nice Earl Grey or a nice chai, and you're in heaven.
I have a confession to make. I've always liked coffee better than tea, but I've always hated myself for it because I've always revered tea drinkers. I don't know if it's the association in my head with not only the high society sounding accent of the British, but that tea dates back. It's not a British thing. It's far East thing. It's Chinese. It's Japanese. It dates back there. And that seems regal and important and ancient. And I revere that in a way. And so I think every time I'm drinking coffee, I view myself as a plebeian. And I view someone like yourself with the last name Shantz and a tea drinker in the morning. I think you're operating on a different wavelength. And your body probably thanks you for it, too. What's your favorite type of tea?
Earl Grey tends to be my go-to. But if I'm out at like a tea place, a nice chai. So I prefer black teas. But if you really want to get something good, creamed Earl Grey, it's like Earl Grey with some vanilla in it, is just amazing. If you put a little bit of honey and a touch of milk, it's perfect.
Do you have any other food takes that run counter to the initial beliefs of people, the unsocialized or socialized take?
All right, this is going to potentially anger some people. Eggs are disgusting. I do not understand somebody just sitting down and eating eggs.
Are you denying, do you hate them being included in things, or just like a boiled egg and just eating an egg?
If they are included in things like a cake or something like that, fine. That's great. But just on their own, like scrambled eggs, an omelet, hard boiled, over easy, however you want to do it, gross.
Wow. I love scrambled eggs. You mix in a little cheese. I'm a big fan of that. So, yeah, but eggs, I could see why eggs are kind of like meh. Definitely wouldn't judge anyone for not wanting to eat them.
Well, that's good.
The next question is from Sean Woodley, the co-author of We the Champs, a very, very popular book about the Raptors championship run. Sean Woodley says, if you're forced to bet money, one of Matt Thomas or Stanley Johnson making an all-star team next year, who would it be? And then adds, geez, maybe I'm more sad than I thought. What do you think?
I think that Sean has a gambling problem if he is asking this type of question to us. But I guess if you have to pick, I would say Stanley Johnson, because he will probably have a more defined role with the team next year. Unless Matt Thomas can show that he can hold up defensively, he will be brought in as an option to shoot just kind of on a few possessions here and there. But Stanley Johnson with his ability to defend will just be included in more lineups.
Maybe let's alter this then. And who's more likely to make All-Star weekend? Because maybe Matt Thomas finds a Steve Novak role and finds himself in the three-point competition. Is that more likely than Stanley Johnson participating in an All-Star game? Because I think it is, actually.
Very, very, very easily more likely, yeah. Matt Thomas, I could clearly see with his shooting acumen going in as into the three-point shot. But Stanley Johnson, I think you'd have to find a family member of his who believes that he's going to be an All-Star, and that's the only people who would bet that way.
Derrick Rose won MVP, man. Anything can happen. You never really know. Nick Spicer asks, who else is left for us to sign? 2019-20 projection.
The one name that I'm kind of keeping an eye on, just because I'm curious what his contract will look like, is Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. I like a lot of what he does. He's just not a shooter, and the Raptors have had success with that type of player before. And, you know, somebody who excels in a lot of different areas of the game, but just doesn't quite have that well-rounded offense to themselves. So he's somebody very easily who, if he signs at or near the minimum, I think that he could very, very clearly outplay his contract.
We had talked about this on the other podcast we did with Adam, and you brought up the same thing, that you really like Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, and I do too. And the next question is, who would you rather take a flyer on, Trey Lyles or Rondae Hollis-Jefferson?
For me, it would be Rondae. I think that we have a lot of, maybe not a lot, we've got enough people in the front court who have their options. So we could play OG at power forward. Siakam fits there. Stanley is big enough for some power forward minutes. We've got Gasol. We've got Ibaka. So there's a lot of big bodies. Whereas with Kawhi and Green gone, we could use a few more minutes or options available at the wing rotation. So I would likely go with Rondae over Trey. And I think what he brings is a little bit more consistent.
I think for me, I would go with Trey Lyles simply for the fact that he is from where I'm from. He's from Saskatoon. And maybe that opens up an avenue for me to get insider information. I say, hey, man, you're from the same spot on the map that I'm from. Does this have meaning to you? Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't. Hopefully we can work something out, man. The next question from Guatam, G_Malcony. Do the Raptors compete with this team, or do they absorb contracts and try to land big names in 2021? We discussed this already, and ad nauseum maybe, but a firm yes or no, which do you think it is?
I think that they trade at least one of the vets. So I don't think that they look to compete and go as far as possible. I think that they are a playoff team, likely around the sixth seed, but begin the process of starting the rebuild towards 2021.
Yeah, definitely. I think my favorite question on here is from Robert A. Senta, at Rob Senta. I have zero regrets, and last year was the best thing ever. Moving forward, who will make up Bench Mob 2.0? What lineups are you most excited to see Nick run with? And you mentioned OG Anunoby at the two, so I'll let you take this one.
Yeah, so I think that starting, just the Raptors really were a switchable team last year between all their defensive wing options. So it wouldn't shock me, based on the current rotation, if it's Lowry at point guard, OG at shooting guard, just kind of nominally. We've got Stanley Johnson at small forward, Siakam at power forward, and then Gasol starting at center, which means that the Bench Mob would be, and I think we're probably on Bench Mob like 3.0 or 4.0 at this point, but it would be, we've got Fred, we've got Norm, Ibaka is in there. I think that sometimes we'll see more opportunity for Chris Boucher this year as he develops. Who am I forgetting? I know I've got some people.
Malcolm Young.
Malcolm, yes, thank you. Malcolm's ability to shoot, I think that he, and he's also a good defender. He's ready for the NBA in that sense. And then we'll bring in Matt Thomas as the occasional gunner. But based on being a little less high-end talent this year, obviously, I would be surprised if we see as many all-bench lineups this year as we did last year.
I have a question of my own. Not only did you just forget Malcolm Miller now, but in your end of season thanks, where you listed everyone, you also forgot Malcolm Miller. What's the deal, man? That's Blake Murphy's best friend. What are you doing?
I don't know. It's clearly a blind spot in my brain, and it's just it slipped my memory somehow. At least Malcolm Miller stands didn't attack me as much as the Jeremy Lin fans did. They really turned on me fast. So that was I'm thankful for Malcolm Miller fans that way.
Well, you know, that's a good thing, right? Is the Malcolm Miller, is his fame is only preceded by his fans' fame. They're known for their civility. And the Malcolm Miller stans are a very vaunted group and beloved and revered in the NBA Twitter social sphere. And I'm so glad that they're a part of it. The three people, they're fantastic. They're also tea drinkers. And maybe that camaraderie they have with you as far as drinking tea was what made them not attack you in that way. And shockingly, we move on to the next question. In Masai, I Trust says, if this season has taught me one thing, Bobby Webster should be spending the next two seasons stalking Giannis. I'm just saying. What do you think about this? I know you said it has been rumored. Obviously, we would all love the idea of Giannis coming to Toronto. Is that viable? If so, how viable? Is it something worth sinking an immense amount of time into? Are we grooming him? What's happening there?
I think it's viable. I do. What percentage I would put it at? Probably not very high. Maybe 5% chance, and that number drops if Milwaukee somehow gets a banner up in the next 2 years. But Masai goes back a long way with Giannis, so that is a positive. We see regularly that free agency decisions are based on, often on trust, most of all. So there's finances, there's trust with an organization and its management. Location is clearly a big draw for some players, but having that successful franchise with a management team that you has shown to be reliable, I think that puts the Raptors in position for Giannis. Plus, he's he loves Milwaukee, so obviously he should love Toronto as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful. I'm talking myself into it. Do I expect it to happen? No. That's looking too far out. And anybody who's counting that chicken, there's a lot of eggs left in the way.
It would be something to have Giannis come, but to have his jump shot struggles still mar his existence on the court, and for that to become the frustration of the fan base. If that were to stop us from getting to the next level, I think that would be kind of like us transcending what Raptors fandom has always been about, which is like, oh, the young guns, Sonny Weems, DeMar and Amir Johnson, maybe they'll be something someday. Whereas we had one great year, seriously, one great year with Kawhi Leonard, and we won it all. And maybe that just stands alone as this beautiful, shining beacon of hope. But having to deal with a superstar who's like, yeah, we can't do it. And somebody who's so obscenely talented like Giannis, whereas DeMar in the past, yes, he did have his struggles, but we knew that. He had built himself into something, whereas Giannis is this otherworldly athletic person and has so many gifts that DeMar didn't have and clearly operates on such a level that DeMar hasn't been able to get to. For him to come and to still struggle with the jump shot would be some sort of terrible thing. But I'd still love him to come if Giannis is listening. Trust me, man. I believe in you. Okay.
With how reactionary the Raptors fan base can be and has been, it does seem like our destiny to eventually sign a premier free agent, only to then have many, many fans disappointed with that.
Amari Carroll.
Yeah.
Amari Carroll.
But
premier free agent.
To a different level. Like, if you could sign one of the top five players in the NBA as a free agent, and like that just changes the destiny of the franchise, there's going to be some people who then see that as a negative eventually. That's just going to happen.
And it reflects bad upon the fan base, which is why when Kawhi signed with the Clippers, I was like, not even sad. I was just like, oh, good, not the Lakers. Thank God. Just because I think the existence with every Raptors writer, I think, had at least one or two Lakers fans in their mentions over the past 5-7 days during this debacle, and it was unbearable. So for it to not be them, and for conventional wisdom insiders to be proved wrong, I think was, even though we lose Kawhi Leonard, I think we all sit back and say, kind of like Thanos at the end of, or at the start of Infinity War, sorry, the end of Infinity War, the start of Endgame, is you're thinking, well, balance has been restored, everything's fine. I have a sense of peace. How about you?
I'm content. I have no anger towards Kawhi Leonard for leaving and picking the Clippers. Like, that's fine. I'm in a post-championship glow right now, and life's pretty good. So congrats to him. I honestly hope that he is happy and successful in Clipperland. And yes, I'm just glad that it wasn't the Lakers.
So, like you said, you hold no ill will. You're not angry at Kawhi Leonard. But just as a thought exercise, if you were angry at Kawhi, how does that manifest for you? How do you act if you're actually angry at Kawhi Leonard? What does Matt Shantz do if he's like mad at Kawhi Leonard?
I'm not really a mad person in general.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So I'd probably make more jokes on Twitter, so it wouldn't come across as angry. It might just be a little bit snarky and sarcastic. I didn't want him to go to the Lakers, one, because I don't like the Lakers. I don't like kind of that entitlement there. But also, him as a third option in the kind of media epicenter of the NBA with LeBron James and Anthony Davis, I wouldn't think that would make him a fun guy anymore. And so I'm happy that he picks somewhere that he can still be a primary option, and he can be a little bit more happy in his day-to-day life, how I picture him.
Yeah, not to mention LA has fantastic jerseys. The big, bold LA script where it's just L and A, and has it's kind of modeled after the Dream Team jerseys. Those are awesome. I can't wait to see him in those.
That would be their good jersey. They do also, you have to admit, have some absolutely atrocious jerseys.
Yes.
In their
okay,
lineup.
They do. Maybe they should just wear the alternate all the time. That's the best way to do it, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think like that's a great place to end it. Matt, thank you so much for coming on, man.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. And the listeners, if you enjoyed this man, which I do, you can find him on Twitter at @m_Shantz. If you want to see anything he's written, just go to Raptor Republic. He's putting stuff up there. And also, there's other podcasts, if you want to listen to old podcasts that he's been on of this. And after you're done listening to this, I hope you have a blessed day. You enjoy your life. And everything's going to be all right. Thank you so much for listening. And goodbye.
Want to hear something amazing? Discover matches all the cash back you earn on your credit card at the end of your first year, automatically, dollar for dollar, with no limit on how much you can earn. Extra cash? Come on, how amazing is that? In fact, it's even more amazing when you realize all the places where Discover is accepted. 99% of places in the U.S. that take credit cards. So when it comes to Discover, get used to hearing yes more often. Learn more at discover.com/yes. 2020 Nielsen Report limitations apply.
Did you know you could shop around for prescription prices? With GoodRx, you can find free coupons at over 70,000 pharmacies and save up to 80%. It's that easy. But don't just take my word for it. Dr. Adam says, I've been telling all my patients about GoodRx. Jacqueline says, my medication was $65 without insurance, but I paid $25. Aubriana says, you don't have to pay full price to live your best life. Couldn't have said it better myself. GoodRx is 100% free. Download the GoodRx app today and start saving. GoodRx is not insurance.